Well, we are very honored today to have one of the leading preachers and one of the leading teachers of preaching in North America with us, Thomas G. Long, who is now the Bandy Professor of Preaching at Candler School of Theology on the campus of Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Tom, prior to that, taught for many years at Princeton Theological Seminary, from which he earned his Ph.D. in 1980. And prior to that, he got his MDiv and his B.A. At Erskine College and Erskine Theological Seminary. Tom has written widely. A number of his books are available. He's written The Senses of Preaching, The Witness of Preaching, the second edition of which, an updated edition, just came out a couple years ago. Testimony, Talking Ourselves into Being Christian, A Chorus of Witnesses, which he co-edited with Calvin Seminary President Neil Planiga some years ago, a collection of outstanding sermons. He's also written some commentaries, including the Interpretation Series 1 on Hebrews and one on Matthew from the Westminster Bible Companion Series. Tom is a great teacher of preaching, a great preacher, as you already saw. He studies widely in homiletical theory, but also in biblical hermeneutics. And so we are very, very happy to have him here today. Those of you who are lectionary preachers know that year B in the Common Lectionary, which begins in Advent, is the mark year. And so we thought it would be a great way to prime our homiletical pumps by having Tom come here and talk to us about preaching the Gospel of Mark today. So please welcome Tom Long.
Thank you very much. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. I know I've got a kind of a tight flight this afternoon, but I found that it's generally better if I get out of town quickly after one of these. I'm looking forward to the conversation. Here's basically the plan for the day. This morning, I want to think about Mark in some rather broad terms and sort of orient ourselves to the gospel and to frame our understanding of what we're looking at when we're looking at Mark. And then this afternoon, I want to dip down into some sample texts in Mark that are just rich as they can be for preaching and are also kind of indicative of the sort of things that we will encounter if you are preaching Mark through the lectionary year as you go through the whole of the gospel. I may fudge a little bit depending on how the time goes and get started with the afternoon, maybe late in the morning. We'll see how things go. If you have ever been to Charleston, South Carolina, you may know that the main intersection in the old part of town is the intersection of Meeting Street and Broad Street. Now, the locals in Charleston call this intersection the Four Corners of the Law. At one corner at this intersection, there is a federal courthouse, federal law. At the second corner, there's a state office building, state law. At the third corner, there is a county courthouse, local law. And at the fourth corner, there is St. Michael's Episcopal Church, God's law. Now, I find that to be an interesting and convenient metaphor to understand the Gospels in the New Testament. If we can imagine another intersection, maybe Church Street and Ecclesiastical Boulevard, and at this intersection, there are four real, concrete, living, witnessing, worshiping congregations: the Church of St. Mark, the Church of St. Matthew, the Church of St. Luke, and the Church of St. John. And they are each distinct. In fact, you can almost tell it in their buildings. If you go to the Church of St. Matthew, the main building on the campus of the Church of St. Matthew is the educational building. The lights are on all night in the educational building. And in the Gospel of Matthew, disciples can be ethically alert, morally alive Christians. The disciples in Matthew are the same frail people who betray Jesus in all of the Gospels, and yet they are disciples who can learn and grow. That's Matthew. If you go catty corner across the street to the Church of St. Luke, the main building there, of course, is the Fellowship Hall. Because in Luke's community, they experience Jesus eating and drinking at table. That's the Church of St. Luke. Go across the street to the Church of St. John, and the building, well, they actually don't have a building. It's a house church, and if you stand outside the window, you can hear them singing in the community of St. John, "We are one in the Spirit, we are one in..." They experience the risen Christ in the loving relationships of the community. There is a realized experience of the eschatological Jesus in the Church of St. John. Raymond Brown, by the way, in his little book, The Churches the Apostles Left Behind, pointed out that the ecclesiology of the Church of St. John was the first to come apart. Because if you experience Jesus in the harmonious, loving relationships of the community, all it takes is a little trouble and you've got a theological problem. And sure enough, by the time we get to 1 John, how can you say you love God when you don't even love the brother or sister who's next to you at the Lord's Supper? If you can't love somebody you can see, how can you love? Yeah, you know, there it goes. It's breaking apart. But what do we find at the Church of St. Mark? Most scholars who look at the Church of St. Mark believe that we will see, of the four churches, the shabbiest building. This is a poor congregation. One of the ways that we can tell that, there are fingerprints of poverty all over the text of Mark. For example, in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus catches the disciples arguing about who is the greatest. And he says to them, in Mark now, he says to them, if you want to be great, you must become as one who serves. Note the language. If you want to be great, what does that imply about them? They aren't great. Over in Luke's church, the same conversation takes place, but of course it takes place at the table. Jesus catches them arguing about who is the greatest at the table, and he doesn't say the same thing. In Luke, he says, those among you who are great must become as those who wait on tables. In other words, in the Lucan community, you've got a mixed economy. There's some who are up at the big house and they get waited on. But when they come down to the Lord's house, they're supposed to reverse roles. And the ones who are of status should become the deacons as a sign of the kingdom. But in Mark, if you want to be great. In all three of the synoptic gospels, Jesus sends the disciples out two by two, and he says to them, take no money. But the Greek is different. In Mark, it's take no copper. Take no pennies. In Luke, it's take no silver. In Matthew, it's take no copper, silver, or gold. You get a sense of the economic disparities among the churches. This is our weakest church economically. Although it is sometimes now disputed, I still think the predominant evidence falls for the Markan community on a community that is being persecuted, actively persecuted. It may be a community in Rome, and it is experiencing direct Roman persecution, although some scholars think that it's not necessarily in Rome, it's in an outlying area, maybe in Palestine, but it is still experiencing the kind of eroding, always threatening violence that the Roman Empire kept applying to groups that it considered not assimilatable into the main program of the government. Now, a good many scholars think you can see that taking place in this beautiful story that's really beautifully preachable as well in the fourth chapter of Mark, starting at the 35th verse. On that day when evening had come, he said to them, let us go across to the other side. And leaving the crowd behind, they took him with them in the boat just as he was. Other boats were with him. A great windstorm arose. Now, the windstorm is viewed to be symbolic of the turbulence that is taking place in the social setting of Mark. So suddenly, there they are in the frail boat, and they've got this turbulence taking place around him. But Jesus is in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they wake up Jesus, and they ask Jesus the question that has been asked by every single church in peril from the New Testament days forward. Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? Now, probably in the Markan setting, they are experiencing literal persecution. But I think this is a good question for the church to consider when other forms of turbulence happen around it. For example, In Atlanta, we are looking at a lot of churches downtown who used to have full pews in the 1950s and 1960s, and now all the young people are gone, and they're down to 45 people who can hardly afford to patch the roof, and it looks like Jesus is asleep and does not care that they are perishing. Or we have other congregations in Atlanta and around, in my experience, who may have a nice, comfortable congregation, but who are bored out of their minds in worship. Everything is right. The stewardship program is good. The Christian education program is intact. Everything is all right, except there is no God in the life of their church. And so they are perishing for lack of vision, excitement, and energy. Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? It is the cry of the church in turbulent circumstances. And believe you me, nobody knows the shape of this, but we're moving into a mark in time economically, aren't we? We don't know what it's going to be like, but we're out there on the sea and the winds are blowing. Teacher, do you not care that we're perishing? He woke up, and you know, if you ask the person on the street what happens here, it would be Jesus calmed the winds. No, not in Mark. Jesus rebuked the winds. Every story in the Gospel of Mark is an exorcism because the demonic is hidden under the everyday and ordinary, and so he doesn't just calm the winds. He rebukes them, and he says to the sea, which is the center of chaos in the ancient world, "Shalom, peace, be still." The wind ceases. There is a dead calm. "Why are you afraid?" he said. "Have you no faith?" And they were filled with great awe and said to one another, "What is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?" All right. Some scholars think we got a nice little snapshot of the social circumstances of Mark. But they aren't just in social circumstances. They're in kind of theological, educational circumstances as well. If you saw the movie Diner, you saw a number of years ago a movie about some restless, listless inner-city young men in inner-city Baltimore who spend a lot of time hanging around together in a diner, just killing time and talking. And one day in the movie, a couple of them decide, we need to get out of the city for a while. So they jump in their car and they just drive. They drive out of the city, they move into the countryside, and they finally come into the beautiful horse country of Maryland. They're taken by the beauty of the pasture. They park the car, they walk over to the fence, and they're looking out at the horse pasture when suddenly in the distance, there comes riding on a beautiful thoroughbred horse, a magnificently outfitted and beautiful young woman. She's in a riding outfit with a crop and obviously aristocratic and a person of means. And here are these two inner city guys watching this beautiful woman come toward them on a horse. And what do? They do what inner city guys do when a beautiful woman comes their direction. They start calling out to her and flirting with her and doing their inner city moves and tricks. And she simply rides by them, looking in their direction for a moment with aristocratic disdain, and keeps on going. And when she's gone, one of them turns to the other and says, "Do you ever get the feeling there's something going on we don't understand?" That's the congregation of Mark. Do you ever get the feeling there's something going on in the world we don't understand? And the good theological news of the Gospel of Mark is that the action and victory of God in the world do not depend upon our understanding and comprehending what God is doing. Now, thank God for the Gospel of Matthew, where we do learn and grow. There's another side to this, but also thank God for the Gospel of Mark, because when we are absolutely mystified about the action of God in the world, the Gospel of Matthew is there to proclaim it does not depend on your gnosis. It does not depend on your insight. When I graduated from seminary in 1971, I was called to a church in Atlanta, Georgia, that had been built in 1948 on a beautiful spot of land next to a farm pond in a copse of trees right next to a neighborhood that was springing up and people were building houses on the GI Bill. It was a perfect, beautiful location for a brand new church in 1948. By the time I got there, the pond had been drained, the copse of trees had been cut, the land around the church had been purchased by a shopping center developer, and the church was left in the middle of the parking lot on a red clay Georgia hill. It was the intention of the developer to buy the church and bulldoze it and get it out of the way, but he ran out of money and there we were. The first year I was there, we had one, oh my gosh, what are we going to do, officers meeting after another. Should we sell and move to the suburbs? Should we advertise in the Saturday paper? Should we hire a youth director and get a snazzy youth program? We're going to perish here. What are we going to do? What are we going? And finally, at one of those meetings, Alec McGill, one of the officers, said, "You know what? We have been in this place since the late 1940s, preaching the gospel, baptizing our children, caring for each other when we are sick, burying our dead, and praising God. I think we ought to just keep on doing that. God's work will get done even if this congregation goes out of existence." Now, Alec had been sitting in the pews of the Church of St. Mark. The gospel of the Church of St. Mark is, do not be afraid when you do not understand it, when it is beyond your powers, when things are going on that transcend your comprehension. God's work is still getting done in the world. It's the mystery faced by the gospel of Mark. Now, one of the criticisms that is occurring these days of narrative preaching is the same criticism that is occurring of praise worship. And that is that it makes God too darn accessible. When I tell a story in a sermon about discovering God gardening in the backyard, or when I encounter God having a conversation with my child at bedtime, or when I see God sitting out under the stars at night, when I tell these stories about the presence of God that infuses every quotidian experience in life, one of the criticisms is it makes God too accessible. Just like praise worship, as if you could saunter in a pair of chinos right up to the Holy of Holies. And one of the interesting things about the Gospel of Mark is that it subverts easy access to God. You do not exactly know what is going on at any point in the Gospel of Mark. If you've been to the Holy Land, you may have seen on some of the churches, like the church at Gethsemane and some of the other tourist churches, a sign over the doorway that says, "No explanations in the church." Now, it's an instruction to tour guides, don't talk when you come inside the church. But I think it may have been written by the author of the Gospel of Mark. Right when you think you can explain what is going on, a trap door opens and you fall down to new and mysterious depths. That is, by the way, I think, the primary purpose behind what is famously called the Markan secret of the God. Don't tell anybody. Don't speak anything about this. There's some fancy theological explanations of that, but I think primarily that functions, do not try to assess what is going on here until you have gotten to the end of it, because you do not fully comprehend the mystery of God. It's deeper than you think, not as accessible as you desire, because it's more powerful than you know. Mark's a strange gospel. I remember John Updike's famous line when he was lecturing on the gospels at St. Bartholomew's Church in New York, and he was asked in the Q&A what his favorite gospel was. And he said without hesitation, it's the gospel of Luke. I love the stories. And then he said, but wait a minute. The gospel of Mark is the oldest, and it's the least prone to wishful thinking. What did he mean by that? Well, in the Gospel of Mark, Mark is not afraid to present a Jesus who is right in the middle of the fight of his life. He does not present a kind of Charlton Heston kind of picture of Jesus who simply walks untouched through the encounters with the demonic and evil in the world. In fact, in Mark, you get the sense that it's a tug of war, and occasionally Jesus is almost overmatched. Whenever he performs a miracle, you sometimes expect Mark to say, and he does on occasion, that Jesus groaned like he was trying to loosen a rusty bolt. In the Gospel of Mark, Jesus encounters the Syrophoenician woman, and you get a sense that the feminist interpretation of this Markan passage is right. The feminist interpretation is that when Jesus encounters this Gentile woman, that the kingdom wants to move in her direction, but Jesus, who comes out of a particular context, is almost, in Mark, not capable of making that move. And right at the last minute, as he is trying to move in her direction, she reaches out and grabs his wrist and gives him a little assist. Mark is not as careful with Christology as Matthew and Luke are. I think I know what Updike was talking about. It is the least prone to wishful thinking, which means that for some Christians, Mark is the most powerful gospel of all. I remember talking to John McClure, who now teaches preaching at Vanderbilt Divinity School. And when he was in Louisville, teaching at the Louisville Seminary, he also taught junior highs in his urban church. And he said, when I was teaching these kids off the street, the gospel that was most powerful for them was the gospel of Mark, because it was combat all the time. And Jesus was in the thick of it. And you could hear him sigh and groan as he attempted a muscular move to bring the kingdom in. All right. There's a little bit of background on Mark. What I want to do now is to explore several ways of framing the Gospel of Mark whole, kind of looking at its literary structure whole, that will help us interpret particular passages. And the first take I want to think about is what might be called the rereading take. The rereading take. Now, why do I call it the rereading take? There was a literary convention in ancient Hellenistic documents by which the authors of those documents would build them in such a way that when you got to the end of them, that you were supposed to go back and read them again, and you would, when you went back through them again, discover the foreshadowings and hints and meanings that had been planted earlier in Mark's gospel. All right? I think Mark is designed precisely that way. Now, let me see if I can show that to you. Take a look at the very first verse of the Gospel of Mark. The very first verse of the Gospel of Mark. The beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Now, that's a throwaway line for most of us, kind of like a little superinscription. But no, that's it. That is the whole thing in the Gospel of Mark. Let me translate it. The beginning is really in Greek arche, which is the which means Genesis. This is the very first word in the Septuagint Old Testament. It's the very first word in the New Testament. Genesis. The good news about Jesus, who has two titles, Christ and Son of God. Messiah and Son of God. I want this half to be Messiah, and I want this half to be Son of God. Genesis, the good news about Jesus, who is
Messiah.
Now, that's the strong term. The Messiah is the expected Davidic restoration. This is the almost military-like figure who is going to restore the fortunes of the people of God. And let me tell you some good news. This is the beginning of that good news about Jesus, who is
Messiah.
Woo! But he is also and that is the relatively weaker term. It has a complex DNA, but it basically comes out of the intertestamental period, the wisdom literature, in which the Son of God title is connected to the suffering servant of God, and by implication, all the way back to the servant songs in the book of Isaiah. This is the one who bears our griefs and carries our sorrows, who suffers on behalf of the people of God. And this is the genesis of the good news about Jesus, who is
Messiah
and
Messiah.
The first line in Hamlet, who goes there? Nay, unfold thyself. There is a sense in which the whole play of Hamlet is an exegesis of the first line. And there is a powerful sense in which the whole Gospel of Mark is an exegesis of the first verse. Now, there's some dispute about that Son of God, whether it's in the original text, but most scholars agree that it's there. And when you know that Jesus is both Messiah and Son of God, both the victor and the sufferer, you know everything there is to know in the Gospel of Mark, right in the first line. And it is 8 chapters before anybody else finds it out. A few demons, just you and the demons, that's all who know. And there are these questions that get asked in the narrative, like, who is this who can command even the wind and the waves? And the reader or hearer of Mark says, come on, everybody, that's Jesus. He's and who is this who can forgive even sin? Oh, come on. That's Jesus. He's 8th chapter. Who do people say that I am? Some say you're John the Baptist. Some say you're one of the prophets. Who do you say that I am? You're but the other shoe does not drop. The Son of God is not there. It's added in some later manuscripts. Some overly anxious scribes began to realize, hey, wait a minute, there are 2 titles here, and added it. But in the original manuscript of Mark, it's not there because Peter has only half of it at that point. We're going to Jerusalem to die. No, no, we're not. Get behind me, Satan. You're not on God's side, but on human side. And so they move from that point toward the cross. And when Jesus is hanging on the cross in Mark 15:39, a Roman soldier looks up and says, that is the point being, smug reader, you too did not know what you were reading until you got to the end. You did not realize the central secret of the Gospel of Mark, that Jesus is only the victorious Messiah by being the suffering servant, and that the suffering, disgraced, and shamed servant is the Messiah. Then we move to the Easter story in 16. Take a look at it. Now, as you know, most scholars believe that the original Gospel of Mark ended at the 8th verse of the 16th chapter. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome brought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They'd been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?" Now, you know the historical background of this. They're not doing anything unusual here. When a Jew died who had some means, that Jew was placed in a family cave, grave, on a ledge, a niche, and for 3 days, people would from the family would come to the grave, they would roll the stone back, and they would take aromatic spices and anoint the body. This was a religious ritual, but it was also a very practical one because you could be prematurely buried. There were lots of cases of people who went into catatonic seizures, who were buried, and then who came back from that. So for 3 days, you go every day into the grave with spices, anoint the body, and look at the body. And after 3 days in the Palestinian heat, you can tell. that's in John when Lazarus is dead and Jesus is coming into Bethany and don't bother, he's been dead 4 days, and already there is a smell. Okay, for 3 days, you go in and you anoint. So they're not doing anything unusual, but they're wondering, who's going to roll the stone away for us? When they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in white, sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. Okay, we've seen that this morning already. But he said to them, now he's going to give them two instructions. Do not be afraid. Do not be alarmed. You're looking for Jesus of Nazareth who was crucified. He's been raised. He's not here. Look, this is the place they laid him. That's the first instruction. Don't be afraid. Second instruction. Go tell his disciples and Peter he's going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. So second instruction, go tell his disciples he'll see them in Galilee. So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. In fact, that's not really the way the sentence ends. It doesn't even end in a proper grammatical way. The best way to transliterate it into English would be, they said nothing to anyone afraid for, dot, dot, dot. Don Jewell, who was a scholar on the Gospel of Mark, had a student when he was teaching at Luther Seminary in St. Paul who decided as a class project to do what others have done, and that was to memorize the Gospel of Mark so that he could perform it as a kind of oral performance. And he did this and then arranged for 2 evenings in his church to recite the Gospel of Mark. And he had made the decision he was going to end it at 16:8 because that's where the original manuscript ended. So he got to this place, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Amen. He immediately knew when he said amen, he had sabotaged the Gospel of Mark. And so the next night when he recited it, he simply ended it. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid, and walked off the stage, leaving the congregation unsettled. Not done. What's this more? There's got to be more. This is, it's unresolved. There's something dangling and missing here. And then suddenly it dawns on you. Go tell his disciples. Who are his disciples? Peter, John, James, the reader, the hearer. I've been following Jesus all the way. Go tell his disciples he'll see you in Galilee. Galilee, where's Galilee? North of Jerusalem. Chapter 1, verse 14. Jesus came to Galilee. The time is now. The kingdom is near. Repent and believe in the gospel. In other words, you didn't understand this gospel the first time you read it. Go back to the beginning, now that you've been to the end, and go back through it, and you will understand it this time. And when you go back through it, you will be able to answer the puzzle that in the Gospel of Mark, there are no post-resurrection appearances. That's because every story in Mark is now a post-resurrection appearance. This is what the risen Christ is doing in the world. You will also see some clues, like that one we saw, I hope, in the sermon this morning, when you go back to the tomb of the Gerasene demoniac. There you are, just like you were in chapter 16, in a cemetery. And there is a man, just like in the cemetery at Easter, who is seated in the position of authority, clothed and in his right mind, proclaiming the gospel. That's an Easter story happening in the middle of with Gerasenes and the demoniac. When you go back and reread it, you see it again in a way that you had not seen it before. There's some other places that we'll notice that as we look at particular texts. The second frame or angle of vision on the Gospel of Mark that gives it a sense of a literary whole might be called the anti-Platonic cosmos. The anti-Platonic cosmos. All right, what's that one about? In the Hellenistic world, every educated person was basically a Platonist. That's the air that they breathe. That's the way they viewed the creation. And in fact, every educated person had read an important essay in their educational process that Plato had written about the nature of the cosmos. It was called Timaeus, and it was in the form of a dialogue between the reader and a philosopher named Timaeus, and it is divided into two big panels with an interlude in the middle. In the first panel, the philosopher Timaeus taught the Platonic view of the cosmos. Now, what is the Platonic view of the cosmos? The creation is a perfectly symmetrical sphere with all of the heavenly bodies arranged in perfect proportion around it. Now, you don't live there, of course. That's the ideal world. You live in the shadow world. You live in the 367th Xerox copy of a Xerox copy of that creation, and you can only dimly see it. That's because you're not a philosopher. The over 50 male who has an education in philosophy is the only person who can see rightly. Oh, you can see a few things. You see birds? You know what birds are? Those are reincarnated people who had flighty personalities. You see women. You know what women are? In the Platonic cosmos, those are reincarnated cowardly males. The cosmos is not morally neutral. When we make arguments today, it's only natural that we're really arguing out of a ethically infused understanding of the cosmos. And the Platonic cosmos didn't like women. It didn't like cowards. It didn't like flighty personalities. And it privileged over 50 male philosophers. The second panel is ethics. How shall we live if this is the way the cosmos is? And then in the middle, there is a hymn to philosophy. Oh, how wonderful philosophy is. And then it says, pity the blind man. The blind man thinks that if he could just get his sight back, oh, he could see. But no, that's just natural sight. Only philosophical sight gives you the truth. All right, there's Timaeus. That's the document that every educated person read. And even if you weren't educated, you breathe this air like convenience store clerks can talk to you about Freudian psychology, id, superego. It's just in the vocabulary. The Platonic worldview was in everybody's vocabulary. The Gospel of Mark, argue some scholars, is also divided into two panels with an interlude. In the first panel, think how it gets started. Jesus comes up out of the muddy waters of the Jordan River with John the Baptist standing beside him. And what happens? The heavens are... The Greek is schizo, like schizophrenic. The heavens are ripped apart. It's a violent action. It's as if Mark is saying, this is what God does to that perfect platonic sphere of the heavens, rips it apart. And then the voice of God says, you want to know what pleases me? That man coming up out of the waters in the Jordan, that's my son, with whom I am well pleased. And he gets up out of the waters and engages in ministry to the very people who are excluded and marginalized in the Platonic cosmos, to women, the lame, and the needy, the poor, and the blind. All right, the ripping apart of the heavens. There is, however, that hymn of interlude. Take a look at it in the 10th chapter of Mark. Starting with the 35th verse. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came forward to him and said to him, Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. And he said to them, What is it that you want me to do for you? They said, Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in glory. But Jesus said to them, You don't know what you're asking. Now, a couple of comments. This is actually composed in the form of a dialogue between a philosopher and his students. Notice how it starts out, Teacher, we want you to do whatever we ask of you. The other thing is the irony here. When we go back and reread Mark to pick up on the previous frame, we will remember this statement that occurs later in the gospel. We want you to let one of us sit at your right hand and one of us at your left. Where are we going to encounter that later? At the cross, the two thieves. So they are ironically asking to participate with Jesus in his crucifixion, and he quite rightly says, you don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with? And they said, we're able. Then Jesus said, well, the cup I drink, you will drink, and the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared. When the ten heard this, they began to be angry with James and John, and Jesus called them and said to them, and it sounds like an ethnic slur is about to take place, you know the Gentiles are those who recognize their rulers and lord it over them. This is not an ethnic slur against Gentiles. This is a description of a Hellenistic culture. This is the way it is in Hellenism. Rulers lord it over people, and their philosophers are tyrants. But this is not the way it's going to be among you. Whoever wishes to become great among you must be your servant. Whoever wishes to be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And then Jesus turns and he walks to the cross. That's the rest of Mark. He walks to the cross. The way of the cross leads home. That's the way we're... But there's one more story. Take a look at 46. They came to Jericho. As he and his disciples and a large crowd were leaving Jericho, Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus. Get it? This is the only miracle in Mark where the recipient of the miracle is named. He's named twice, once in Aramaic and once in Greek. This is the son of Plato. Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus, a blind beggar. How ironic. Where is he sitting? He's sitting beside the roadside. Weak translation. He's really sitting beside the way. If the way of the cross leads home, he's sitting beside the way. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout out and say, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. The son of Plato meets the son of David. Many sternly ordered him to be quiet, but he cried out even more loudly, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stood still and said, "Call him here." And they called the blind man, saying to him, "Take heart, get up, he's calling you." Throwing off his cloak, look it up in Greek, it's a philosopher's cloak. Throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. Then Jesus said to him, "What do you want me to do for you?" We've heard that question before, right? That was what Jesus said to the two disciples who do whatever we want you to do. The blind man said, "My teacher, let me see again." Powerful question. And Jesus said, "Go, your faith has made you well." And immediately he regained his sight and followed him on the way. The Hellenistic world has moved in this story to following Jesus. From the cosmos of tyranny to the cosmos of the cross. The Gospel of Mark is an anti-Platonic cosmos. Last take on this. This is the take of the new creation. The new creation. Take a look at Mark 8. Feeding of the 4,000. In those days, when there was again a great crowd without anything to eat, he called his disciples and said to them, "I have compassion for the crowd because they've been with me now for 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come from a great distance." His disciples replied, "How can one feed these people with bread here in the desert?" He asked, "How many loaves do you have?" They said, "Seven." Then he ordered the crowd to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves, and after giving thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to distribute, and they distributed them to the crowd. They had also a few small fish, and after blessing them, he ordered that these too should be distributed. They ate and were filled, and they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full. Now there were about 4,000 people. And he sent them away. Immediately he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. All right? 7 baskets full. What do you think that means? This is the second feeding. Go back to the first one in the 6th chapter, 30th verse. We'll go all the way down to the 41st verse. Taking up the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and blessed and broke the loaves and gave it to his disciples and set it before the people. And he divided the 2 fish among them all, and all ate and were filled, and they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and the fish. Then keep on reading verse 47, and it gets really strange. When evening came, the boat was out on the sea. He was alone on the land, and when he saw that they were straining at the oars against an adverse wind, he came toward them early in the morning, walking on the sea. He intended to pass them by, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for all saw him and were terrified, but immediately he spoke to them, "Take heart, it's I, do not be afraid." Then he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased, and they were utterly astounded. And here comes a complete non sequitur, for they did not understand about the loaves. Yeah, we don't understand about the loaves either, do we? 7, 12? What is there to understand about the loaves? Most scholars think that what we have here is an eschatological sign of fullness. And the two numbers are significant. The 12 is the restoration of the 12 tribes. We are promised in Ezekiel and other places that the 12 tribes will be brought back together at the new creation and will be unified into one people with the praise of God on their lips. So we've got a new eschaton, a new creation happening here. And 7, of course, is the biblical number of fullness. Well, that's good, but there's also this other interesting facet in Mark that reinforces that. I'm going to give you a series of verses. If you want to write them down, you can look them up later. Here they are, 132 and 135. 132, and when it was evening, 135, and when it was morning. 435, and when it was evening. Then there's an implied morning in the 5th chapter. 6:47, and when it was evening. 6:48, and when it was morning. 11:19, and when it was evening. 11:20, and when it was morning. 14:17, and when it was evening. 15:1, and when it was morning. 15:42, and when it was evening. 16:2, Easter, and when it was morning. Now, the Jews, of course, measure a day that way. It moves from evening to morning. But what does that sound like? And when it was evening and when it was morning? That's creation. That's Genesis. Arche, Genesis. If you count these pairs, evening and morning, guess what? There are 6 of them. And then we move into the great Sabbath rest of Easter. A lot of us who are Protestants have in our worship spaces baptismal fonts that are octagonal. There's not one here, but there is in the church where I worship and in a lot of churches. And many congregations don't know why the fonts are octagonal. And it's because God created the world in 6 days, rested on the 7th day, and recreated the world in Jesus Christ on the 8th day. And Mark is a new Genesis. It is the recreation of the world in Jesus Christ, and it spills over into eschatological fullness. Now we understand about the loaves, the 12 and the 7. All right, these are, I hope, 3 kind of interesting frames to hold as we read the Gospel of Mark whole. Now I want to take a look at the 1st chapter of Mark, and then I'm going to stop, and we're going to see if you've got any Q&A, and then we'll go to lunch. Now we're going to dip down into particular texts. When I was teaching at Columbia Seminary in Atlanta, and it came time in the intro to preaching for the students to preach their very, very first baby sermons, first time they had ever preached, we would say to them, you can preach on any passage that you want in the Bible, any passage that you want for your first sermon, as long as it comes from the 1st chapter of the Gospel of Mark. Now, there's a lot of good stuff in the 1st chapter of the Gospel of Mark, but do you know that about 75 or 80% of the students picked the very same passage? It starts at the 35th verse. In the morning, while it was still very dark, he got up and went out to a deserted place, and there he prayed. And Simon and his companions hunted for him, and when they found him, they said to him, "Everyone is searching for you." He answered, "Let us go on to the neighboring town so that I may proclaim the message there also, for that is what I came out to do." And he went throughout Galilee proclaiming the message in their synagogues and casting out demons. Now, why did 75% of the students pick that passage? There are all kinds of good things in the 1st chapter of Mark. Why that one? Well, it became clear when you heard the sermons, which were as predictable as the choice of text. The sermon sounded like this. Jesus had a busy day in Capernaum. He'd been teaching and preaching and ministering, and he was tired. He was exhausted. He was burnt out. Students who are burnt out, not Jesus, but so. And so early in the morning, he went out to a lonely place, and he had some quiet time with his father. And so when you are exhausted or burnt out, you should have some quiet. Well, that may be a good sermon, but not on this text. The word deserted place, sometimes lonely place, is actually aramos in the Greek, and it means desert. It means wilderness. And the Markan readers and hearers were competent in the Old Testament. And when you hear the word desert and your Bible is the Old Testament, the Hebrew scripture, the mind goes to all of those places that the children of Israel were out in the wilderness, the places where the wilderness appears in the Old Testament. And it is the place where the holy and the demonic vie against each other. It's the place where the people of God rebel against God, where holy vocation is in trouble. This is not an azalea garden. This is the wilderness, the desert. Jesus has gone to the most dangerous place he could possibly go to pray. And in case you missed it, Mark has been hitting this baby like a drum all the way up to this point in the first chapter. Look at verse 3. The voice of one crying out, where? John the baptizer, verse 4, appeared where? Verse 12. And the Spirit immediately drove Jesus out into the... He was in the 40 days tempted by Satan and was with the wild beasts, and the angels waited on him. I mean, this is the place of terror and temptation, and you almost expect Jesus in the middle of his prayer to be tempted. And he is. There you are. Everybody's looking for you. They loved you in Capernaum. Come on back to Capernaum. Now, should Jesus go back and be the wonder boy in Capernaum? Be the pastor of First Christian Reformed in Capernaum? Or should he go on to chapter 15 where they string him up on a tree? Now, I know which way I'd go. Let us go on to the other towns. That is why I came out. The gospel is here today. Because Jesus went that way and not that way in the desert. Now notice that what is being tempted here then is his baptismal vocational identity. That when Jesus comes up out of the muddy waters of the Jordan, he is not just given a blessing. This is my son with whom I am well pleased. He's given a story. He inherits the identity that God has given to the people of God always, that the children of Israel denied and disobeyed. This is the identity that Jesus is given. And he is at this juncture, right in the desert, under the duress of those who want him to come back and be somebody else, tempted to live out another story. That's really what the temptation is. It is an attempt to give you a narrative other than the narrative that you are given in your baptism. At Emory, I inherited Bishop Tutu's office. I also inherited his telephone number, and I get some very interesting calls. And I, along with my colleagues, are great admirers of Desmond Tutu, and it was a shock to me to discover that he is not universally admired in South Africa. There are a lot of people in South Africa who think that he is way too soft on the old Afrikaners, that he is way too quick to give forgiveness and reconciliation. In fact, one of his lieutenants said, "You would think by the time you got to be Desmond's age that he would have learned how to hate a little bit more." But there is a problem with Desmond. He actually believes the gospel. He knows the story.
and he will not exchange it for another one, even though there is a mighty temptation to. When I was a senior in high school, I had a part in the senior play. Actually, it's a little bit of an exaggeration. I was too shy to have a part in the senior play. I was the sound man in the play. My job was to stand in the wings, and when somebody was to knock on a door, I had two sticks in front of a microphone. I had two wires with batteries and a bell, and when the phone was supposed to ring, I'd put the wires together, watching to see when the actor picked up the phone so that I could stop the bell ringing. The director of the play was a fresh-faced, young, and beautiful new English teacher who had just come to our school. We all had a crush on her, and she poured herself into us in the play. She would come early in the morning, teach her classes, and then rehearse us on lines in the afternoon, run, get a McDonald's hamburger, come back to the school, and she would go through a rehearsal with us. She would stay late painting props and then come back the next day and do it. She just poured herself into the play and into us. And on opening night, we were ready. We knew the play. It was a comedy. The auditorium was filled with our friends and our families. And it was a rip-roaring success. People were roaring with laughter all the way up to the middle of the second act. In the middle of the second act, one of the actors forgot his line. You could see him out there squirming, trying to remember what the script called for him to say and do, but he couldn't remember it. The other actors were beginning to fidget on stage. It was a bad moment. And I was standing in the wings next to that young English teacher who had directed the play, and she was leaning forward and just about to whisper his lines to him when suddenly he spoke. It wasn't the line he was supposed to speak. He made it up, but it was funny, and people laughed, and we relaxed. We'd made it past a bad moment. But with the laughter of the audience ringing in his ears, he made up another line. It was funny, too. Not as funny as the first one, but it was funny, too. And with that laughter ringing in his ears, he made up another one, and then another one, and then another one, until the play was simply spinning out of control. I don't know how we got out of that. I'm not even sure we did get out of it. All I can remember is that English teacher standing in the wings with tears pouring down her cheeks. When we are baptized, we are given a story. But with the laughter of the world ringing in our ears, we are tempted to make up another lie. And God stands in the wings and watches. And watches the temptation. Let's stop here and see if there are some questions, rebuttals, extra insights in the text we've looked at. If you have a question or comment you'd like to make, I think Scott wants you to come up to the microphone at the front. Anything on your mind that you want to ask or say? Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious, you were talking about the story of the Syrophoenician woman,
yep.
And from the feminist theologian view, mm-hmm. about how I think she almost had the force of the arm, you said.
Mm-hmm.
Can you briefly go over that story and show us what you were talking about?
Let me tell you the story. Jesus encounters out in the borderlands between Jewish and Gentile territory, encounters a Syrophoenician woman. She's got a sick daughter, and she begs Jesus to heal the daughter. And Jesus at first puts her off and says, I'm sent only to the house of Israel. It's not right to give to dogs what is reserved for children. That's a epithet for Gentiles. And some scholars want to say, actually, the word means puppies, and Jesus is being kind to her. And she says, yes, Lord, but even the dogs can get the crumbs that right. fall off the table. She also puts herself into the context of the Son of David title and so on. And The feminist take on this is that Jesus is pictured in Mark as articulating the traditional view of the theology of Israel, that the Messiah is sent only to the house of Israel. Now, the Gospel of Mark wants to get to the place that it becomes a gospel for Gentiles too. And in Matthew, you get the same story appears, well, almost the same story. She's a Canaanite woman in Matthew.
Okay.
Which, if it had been written in Alabama, in Mark, it would be, she was a woman from up north. Matthew, she was a Yankee.
Okay.
Canaanite is the old enemy, the old ethnic enemy.
Okay.
But in Matthew, Jesus almost magisterially walks through the steps necessary to move from this place to that place. You don't get that in Mark's gospel. You get a kind of a Jesus standing his ground, the woman saying what is necessary to flip the plot of the story. Now, there are a couple of things you could say about that. One is, if you really want to take a strong feminist take on that, the woman liberates Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
I would stop a little short of that theologically myself. The woman doesn't so much liberate Jesus. I think Mark has a notion of Jesus pushing against the demonic forces, and occasionally he's up against one that the shoulder can't quite move. You remember in Mark it says, when he went to his hometown, he couldn't do any mighty work because of their unbelief. You know, you get a sense that this is not just a piece of cake for Jesus to be able to push back the demonic forces. And here we're trying to push back the whole heritage of Israel. And she says what is necessary to kind of give that extra ounce that turns the tide. Now, is this unheard of in Jewish literature? Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, there's a whole genre of rabbinical stories in which rabbis are absolutely presented as knowing everything, but they get taught something by a child or a woman. In fact, there's a famous rabbinical statement, no one has ever taught me anything except a child and a woman. And it becomes a kind of a manifestation of the way God works mysteriously in the world through that which is of no, you know, social standing in that particular circumstance. So was that?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Good question. Oh, let's get here and while
okay.
You're coming in. Yeah.
All right. I appreciate the frameworks that you gave us, and I'd like to do a series on Mark. I also have a congregation that's excited about the church year and the lectionary.
Right.
And I'm wondering just a little advice about what you would say in terms of a series on Mark, and if you have any comments on the lectionary too.
Yeah. Great question. Two cheers for the lectionary. And I say two cheers for the lectionary because I can make a long list of virtues about the lectionary. Everything from how it teaches the life of Christ, how it lifts up texts that we wouldn't preach, to how it's got resources for preachers out there that are relatively inexpensive and many on the internet. And so, virtue after virtue after virtue of the lectionary. However, the lectionary is in some ways a relic of Christendom. It is designed for a culture that lives the rhythms of the Christian year. And the congregations I preach to, most of them do not live the rhythms of the Christian year. And they have lost, they're biblically and theologically amnesiac. They don't know the difference between Jeremiah and a geranium. And the lectionary... Hyperbole. The lectionary is like, well, any kind of pericope preaching is like reaching up to wallpaper and you've got the text, but the pattern is missing. You can't see the pattern. And so if I were going to preach to a congregation, I would use the lectionary lots of the time, but I would feel perfectly free to interrupt the flow of the lectionary and to do a little pattern teaching. And sometimes you give a whole sermon to that. Sometimes you tantalize people in a sermon so that they say, this is one of the best things that people can ever say after a sermon, wow, I'd like to know more about Mark. How can I do that? And then have a place where they can do that in the educational life of the church. Or I am increasingly, and I don't know how you feel about this, because this is, I was taught not to do this in seminary, but I am increasingly never reading scripture to a congregation until I have done a little contextualizing of it before I read it, so that they can have hooks to hang it on, because I think those hooks are missing for most people out there. And so I try to give that. I mean, I think we are in the business now of rebuilding people's scriptural competence. And that's going to take more than just episodic, lectionary style pericope kinds of preaching. So am I speaking to your question? Okay. We'll take this one and then we'll go to lunch.
Two passages that you presented to us from Mark, the Legion and as well as Bartimaeus. When you go to the Matthew Gospel, Matthew seeing double. Can you elaborate as to why Matthew sees double?
I have an idea about that anyway. I think there is a hermeneutical principle in Matthew. I am among those who think that the author of Matthew is a Jewish Christian. There are some people right on this point who don't think he's a Jewish Christian, and I'll say why. But I think he's a Jewish Christian. And I think he has, I think here's the social circumstance of Matthew. I think Matthew is written to a group of Jewish Christians right at the moment when they have either been kicked out or walked out of the synagogue. And they now have the issue of, when they were over in the synagogue, the issue for them was, how do I integrate my belief in Jesus as the Messiah with my Judaism? Now that I'm in the little ecclesial setting, the church setting, there's been a figure ground reversal, and now it's, how do I integrate my memory of Judaism into my Christian churchly faith? And the answer of Matthew is not dismissal, but intensification. You used to give alms, you used to pray, you used to fast. Well, keep on doing it. But don't do it the way you used to do it. Intensify it. You have heard it said, but I say unto you, intensify it. And so one of the ways that that intensification technique shows up is when Mark gives Matthew one Gerasene demoniac, Matthew doubles it. Jesus did two. Okay? And the place that is in dispute about that, that's kind of funny, is the entry into Jerusalem, where the Old Testament text is Hebrew parallelism. Your king rides on a foal, the colt of a donkey. And that's one animal, of course, in the poetry. It's just parallelism. But Matthew has Jesus riding both of them. And so a lot of scholars say, oh, he cannot be a Jew. He wouldn't have made that mistake. And I say, no, this is another. He is really fulfilling that Zechariah passage in every way, and intensification. That's what I think. Okay, let's go to lunch, and when we come back, we'll start hitting some more of these texts that are great to preach.